Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. Hi, I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, October 26th. I want to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. Let's start with announcements. The Earth First Journal is issuing a call for submissions for the winter issue. We are currently seeking submissions for the winter issue of the Earth First Journal. We're looking for artwork, high-resolution photographs, poetry, and other creative writing, critical analysis, reflections, how-to guides, reviews, and especially updates from your campaigns. Really, we'll take anything that puts the Earth first. The normal deadline for the winter or Yule issue is November 1st. However, due to Hurricane Irma, our fall Mabon issue was delayed, and we just sent it out to print today. They're speaking about 2 weeks ago. We're not sure if we will have to push the winter issue back or we'll be able to move forward on schedule. We will update the newswire with that info when we figure it out, and apparently they haven't in the last 2 weeks. So, for now, please try and send in your submissions by November 1st, but maybe you could wait a day or two. Limit the articles to 3,000 words and keep reviews between 250 and 500 words, and send us your letters to the editors. The fall issue did not include the mail section, simply because we didn't get enough letters commenting on the journal. Only you can fix that. Send your submissions for the winter issue of the Earth First Journal just as soon as you can. And turning to Northern California, Humboldt Redwood Company's new road proposal has been rejected by the California Department of Fire and Forestry due to lack of information, including murky descriptions of unstable landslide areas and no biological analysis. While this is a setback for the company, the proposal could be refiled at some point. The blockaders have sworn they will defend this mountainside in the headwaters of the Mattole from any new road building, in addition to logging and herbicides. And you can find out more information at the Earth First Newswire. And there's a call to action. From Cascadia Forest Defenders, on October 23rd, Cascadia Forest Defenders erected a road blockade at the entrance to the W Timber Sale to protest the current logging on national forest land. Already, clashes between loggers and protesters have resulted in one protester sustaining minor injuries. Protesters aim to send Seneca Jones Timber Company plan to destroy thousands of acres in the McKenzie watershed. The road blockade consists of large slash piles, multiple cars, and a refrigerator, all serving as an anchor for a human-occupied platform suspended 80 feet up in a Douglas fir. We're protecting drinking water, biodiversity, the stable climate, and ultimately our own survival, said Scrimshaw Forest of the Cascadia Forest Defenders. We oppose resource extraction and deforestation. The sale is part of the 2,000-plus acre goose project in the Willamette National Forest, just a few miles from McKenzie Bridge. Logging began on October 16th. California Department Cascadia Forest Defenders states that this blockade isn't about stripping Oregonians of jobs, but stopping the loggers from destroying one of the last intact roadless areas. The group hopes the companies the loggers work for are paying their employees for a full day's work and the loggers can take a day off to go enjoy life away from their chainsaws. Folks are needed as soon as possible at the blockade to help the folks out there. There is currently many law enforcement officers present. If they leave, those there might be vulnerable to other attacks from the loggers or others upset by the protest. And for more information, call the following phone number. 541-554-2519 to contact the Cascadia Forest Defenders. That number once again, 541-554-2519. And Bite Bag Magazine reports that animals are not commodities, we are not commodities. On the 4th of October will be held an animal farming summit in the Clermont-Ferrand in France. Most of the websites on this server are participants and exhibitors of this grotesque production of violent and obscene cruelties toward non-human animals, all the while killing the land and exploiting those who work them. We had the capacity and the means to shut down these websites, so we did. And there's a list of about 12 websites. No compromise in defense of Mother Nature. Animals, whether human or non-human, are products, slaves, pets, or commodities that we can objectify the ways we want to. A large group of humans, especially white, rich, or strong males, actually do think that everything around them is exploitable and they can bend everything to bend their will. Well, we will prove them wrong. This is our cyber guerrilla anonymous way of saying F you. Their infrastructures are weak and vulnerable. There is also a call out for a week of international anti-species action from 30th of October until the 5th of November. And the call out has been translated into several languages. And it's called the Contagio Antispecista. Anyway, looks like the front lines are on the internet too. And in Australia, a court case has been won against Tasmanian anti-protest laws in this story by Michael Slezak of the Guardian newspaper. The former Australian Greens leader Bob Brown has won a landmark high court fight against Tasmanian anti-protest laws passed in 2014 and under which he was charged in 2016. Brown, the third person arrested under the Workplaces Protection from Protesters Act of 2014, argued the laws directly targeted implied freedom of political expression in the Constitution and were therefore unconstitutional. The landmark case stemmed from Brown's arrest while filming a video about an anti-logging protest at La Poyna State Forest in Tasmania's northwest in January of 2016. The Tasmanian government dropped the charges against Brown and his co-arrestee Jessica Hoyt once they mounted a high court challenge, but Brown continued the challenge to protect future environmental actions, arguing they impinged on an implied right to free speech in Australia's constitution. In a 183-page judgment, the court ruled in favor of Brown and Hoyt by a 6-1 majority. The law prohibited protesters from preventing, hindering, or obstructing businesses, even in public areas such as state forests or the access points to areas where commercial activities are conducted, if they ought to have known the impact of their political activity would have on the business. Speaking after the decision was handed down, Brown told The Guardian it was a great day for Australian democracy. The High Court said, "There is a right to political expression and we will uphold it. You can't just start jailing people on account of their political beliefs or peaceful actions they might take to uphold those beliefs." At the hearing in May, Brown's counsel, Ron Merkel, told the court the law discriminated against protesters by allowing companies to give consent to certain political activities, in effect silencing only those opposed to logging. Merkel described the law as unusual and without precedent in Australia because police powers to order protesters to move on and the automatic ban on them returning for 4 days were only enlivened when they agitated political, environmental, social, cultural, or economic issues. Michael O'Farrell, the Solicitor General of Tasmania, explained to the court that the charges against Brown had been dropped because the police had misapprehended the illegal status of the area he had been found in and that it was not a business premises or access area. O'Farrell submitted the law was not designed to ban protests per se, but only those intended to or could be imputed to have intended to stop or hinder lawful business activity and successfully had that effect. He suggested that there would be nothing unlawful about protesters holding signs outside a logging area and standing aside to allow vehicles to enter. O'Farrell accepted the public is allowed to use state forests where their use is not incompatible with forestry uses, but said that doesn't mean Brown and Hoyt have some sort of freestanding right to protest in the area. The majority of the court agreed the laws did breach the Constitution's implied freedom of speech. In particular, they ruled that by stopping members of the public from carrying out protests on public forests, forestry land, and related business access areas, The laws impugned those free speech provisions. And the British Columbia fish farm injunctions against protesters have been lifted, at least for now. Injunctions against three First Nations activists protesting a fish farm off the northern coast of Vancouver Island was temporarily suspended Wednesday by the company. Marine Harvest Canada, the owner of Port Elizabeth Fish Farm, was officially occupied by activists last Thursday night. Notices were served to two protesters occupying Port Elizabeth and one protester occupying Swanson Island, a fish farm approximately 10 kilometers away, also owned by Marine Harvest. But early Tuesday morning, protesters were forced to pack up their tent and leave Port Elizabeth. When protesters were served with a notice to appear in court for an injunction hearing, all protesters vacated our worksite, said Ian Roberts, the company's director of public affairs. We have since adjourned the court hearing on condition that we can reset it upon 36 hours' notice to the defendants should they return to the site. But Sherry Moon, one of the first three female First Nations occupiers, said that they left due to extreme weather, not the injunctions. We only left because of weather, says Moon. Winds were hitting over 35 knots and our tents were blowing over, touching our noses. Marine Harvest said the protesters' safety was a major concern, but that they filed injunctions because protests may have contributed to approximately 5,000 fish dying. Marine Harvest said the protesters' safety. Port Elizabeth was previously empty, but since Friday, ships have restocked the pens with juvenile Atlantic salmon with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police presence. Marine Harvest is blaming protesters for the death of salmon that was being restocked in a pen off the northern coast of Vancouver Island. A statement on the company's website from production director Doogie Hunter said that it's unusual for fish to die being transferred. We estimate 2 or 3% of the fish delivered did not make the transition from freshwater to saltwater, which is very rare, the statement said. We had to adjust our delivery schedule to daylight hours to address safety issues concerning activists protesting at the delivery site, which has resulted in fish being held for up to 10 additional hours within the delivery vessel. Another hour was delayed when protesters attempted to block delivery. These delays have caused additional stress to the fish, which may have added to the mortality. But protesters disagree. You can't put that on us, said Moon. We're only four women. We're peaceful. We document the restocking. We ask questions, but there is no way we have blocked them or have the ability to block them. They went ahead with their work. Their restocking was successful. Restocking of fish farms is an important subject discussed at a meeting in Alert Bay last week. 40 leaders from 8 different nations met with Premier John Horgan, demanding that a province remove all open net fish farms from their collective territories. Horgan did not commit to abolishing the fish farms, but said that there was a cutoff date for restocking. If those leases are up in less than 2 years, they shouldn't be able to restock. Port Elizabeth's provincial license expires in June of 2018, and it takes juvenile fish 18 to 24 months to mature. Oregon did comment to meeting with leadership in the future, but Hereditary Chief Willie Moon from Baswadu First One Nation said that wasn't good enough. Port Elizabeth Fish Farm is in our territory without our consent, and we want them out. We have been fighting against fish farms for 30 years. We will continue to pressure the province to meet with us as soon as possible. But the key is to have all of us there, First Nations and both levels of government. The federal minister has to be there. For now, the third occupation is on hold, but Sherry Moon says we're prepared to go back at any time. And from Australia, we read the Sea Shepherd ship, the Steve Irwin, set sights on Adani, a coal mining company, in defense of the Great Barrier Reef. Sea Shepherd is most well known for defending the whales in their Antarctic feeding grounds, however, the place where they were born. Their home in the waters of the Great Barrier Reef face an even bigger threat than the Japanese whaling fleet in the form of Adani's proposed Carmichael coal mine, Jeff Hansen, managing director of Sea Shepherd Australia, has said. The increase in vessel traffic causing ship strikes, spills, and noise pollution will have a catastrophic impact on Australia's whales. If the Australian government will not oppose whaling by Japan, The very least it can do is to protect the whale's birthing grounds and put an end to this madness of the Adani coal mine. Recent polls show that the majority of Australians oppose the Adani coal mine, and why shouldn't they, with such a corrupt and dishonest operator who has already polluted the Great Barrier Reef, who shows no regard for the health of our planet and is cozying up to our government for almost a $1 billion concessional loan of Australian taxpayers' money. On top of that, the negligible jobs on the table put at risk 64,000 indirect or indirect jobs the Great Barrier Reef creates, Mr. Hansen stated. The Sea Shepherd's flagship vessel, the Steve Irwin, has defended the whales in their Antarctic feeding grounds for over a decade and protected the whales off the Kimberley coast and the Great Australian Bight. Once more, the Steve Irwin will defend the whales, this time in the Great Barrier Reef and Operation Reef Defense in opposition to Adani's coal mine, with an urgent engine overhaul underway. Given most of the air we breathe comes from our oceans, they are truly our life support system. However, through the burning of fossil fuels, our oceans are warming and becoming more acidic, having a massive impact on our Great Barrier Reef, phytoplankton, and the overall health of our ocean ecosystems. Quite simply, our planet's ability to support life hangs by a thread, and if we want to have a livable climate in the future for our children, we simply cannot allow this Adani coal mine to go ahead. Losing this one is not an option, Mr. Hansen said. Sea Shepherd Australia is part of the Stop Adani Alliance, a campaign that is fast becoming the biggest movement in the country, a growing network of organizations who stand together to stop the Adani Carmichael coal mine, rail, and port project. And for more information, you could go to www.stopadani.com. That's stopadani.com. And in Turkey, we unfortunately have to report the death of two environmental activists. The two were killed, apparently, in an attack on their house by a man who apparently has been paid by the local marble company. This was a dream of retirement, said the family, who asked to remain anonymous due to fear of reprisals. The couple moved here for inner peace, then they came up against the marble companies. They could not avoid them. The road up to their home passes from the turquoise coastline of the Aegean through pomegranate and orange groves to a dusty orange quarry, one of more than a dozen in Finike. The open-cast mines divert rivers, blast rocks with TNT, and stir up dust that chokes the surrounding vegetation. When the couple discovered that some had also been opened close to heritage sites in contravention of licensing regulations, they took action. Long involved with left-wing politics, consumer rights groups, and residents' associations, the couple linked up with several friends to form a group called Torres Seder. Our initial aim was to educate people about the environment, but when we realized the quarries were damaging the forest, we started a campaign against them, said Behram Tezel, the co-founder. I knew it was dangerous, but I didn't think it would lead to murder. But they were up against powerful business interests. Turkey boasts 40% of the world's marble reserves, and 9 out of 10 quarries are found in Anatolia. They are a mainstay of the regional economy and the country's $2 billion a year natural stone export business. China is currently the biggest customer, but Turkish marble is also found in Disneyland, the White House, the Vatican, Burj Khalifa, the Bundestag, and luxury hotels across the world. Undaunted, Ali, Eisen, and their fellow campaigners launched a successful challenge that shut down two marble companies, Bartu Murmur and Bahçeşi Bar. Bartu Murmur fought back with a defamation lawsuit against Ali, but Ali won again in March of 2017. The judge not only acquitted him, but also canceled the company's operating license. Hailing the victory, Ali predicted it would be the first of many. Before, citizens were scared to sue companies. Now the decision will encourage all environmentalists, he declared. 2 months later, however, he and his wife are dead. Today, the murder scene has been cleaned up, but the hallway is still pocked with bullet marks, as is the window over the threshold. Police say Ali was gunned down with a sawed-off shotgun as he opened the front door and shone a flashlight towards the intruder. He then fell to the ground close to where he had early discarded his beekeeping gloves, hat, and veil, which still lie in a heap on the stairs. The killer is then assumed to have chased Asen to the veranda where she had gone to scream for help. Strangely, she was found with her arms above her head as though she'd been dragged to the site and her body was face up, although forensic experts say she was shot from behind. The neighbors who live out of sight but within earshot say they heard nothing. A suspect, Ali Emak, was quickly found and arrested. He confessed to carrying out the execution. In return, he said, for the promise of 50,000 lire, approximately $10,000, from a quarry owner who he knew only by the alias of Ugly. Emak said he was paid 3,000 lira up front and promised the rest on completion. He was instructed to make the killing look like a robbery. This ought to have been where the Turkish justice system cranked into high gear to track down those behind the assassination. But instead, it was the starting point for months of delay, obfuscations, and another death that frightened and frustrated activists and raised wider questions about the country's slide away from the democratic rule of law. Within weeks, the suspect had changed his testimony to say he acted alone. But later on, he was found dead in a high-security prison while under suicide watch. The murder of Ali and Asin is a sign of the new climate in Turkey. A campaigner for the North Forest Defense Conservation Group owner, Agul, said, "Ecologists strongly suspect that there is more to this case than individual motives. The attack on the government is now the biggest in our country's history. Their murder can be seen as a message to others. It shows how far the business interests are willing to go." A new study has revealed that 3/4 of all the honey worldwide is contaminated with neonicotinoids, a widely used class of bee-killing pesticides. "There's almost no safe place for a bee to exist," said one of the study's authors. "The widespread use of these pesticides has contributed to the worldwide decline of honeybees. Between 2016 and 2017, beekeepers in the United States reported up to 33% of their colonies had been lost. When we rely on bees to pollinate 71 of the 100 crops that provide 90% of the world's food, the consequences for our environment and our food supply could be catastrophic. We're going all out to ban these toxic pesticides and save the bees." And that's from environmentcalifornia.org. The pesticide levels found in 198 worldwide honey samples were below the level considered safe for human consumption, but for bees it is a death sentence. Neonicotinoids work as nerve agents. They attack the bees' brains and their ability to learn and navigate, and make them more susceptible to parasites and disease. "It's outrageous that we would continue to use the pesticides known to harm bees when it's bees, not pesticides, that make our farms and food possible. We've been making steady progress to save the bees. Earlier this year, a bee species became the first ever in the continental United States to win protection under the Endangered Species Act, and in 2016, Maryland became the first state to ban the consumer use of neonicotinoids." And if you'd like more information, please go to environmentcalifornia.org. And there's been a breaking new discovery on the impact on salmon farms have on the wild. Sea Shepherd and scientist Alexa Morton have new evidence on the impacts that salmon farms have on wild fish in British Columbia in Canada. Sea Shepherd's research vessel, the RV Martin Sheen, is currently in the middle of Operation Virus Hunter 2, a salmon defense campaign off the coast of British Columbia, assisting Morton in her investigation on the impact that salmon farms have on wild salmon and herring populations in the province. On September 18th, Fisheries and Oceans Canada vessel Weaver Bay visited both marine harvest salmon farms occupied by First Nations. DFO officer Greg Plummer told First Nations that if they try to blockade the restocking of the marine harvest midsummer farm, they could be charged with interfering with a lawful fishery. The Midsummer Island salmon farm was occupied by First Nations on September 4th. Later that night, the 53-meter Norwegian-registered Victoria Viking arrived and poured Atlantic salmon into one of the pens. This action was in direct violation of the demands of the Muskawa Dawasdaumuwaks and other nations. First Nations have informed Marine Harvest and Cermaq to remove all farmed salmon from their territorial waters. This 30-year struggle of telling government that they don't want salmon farming in their territories has taken a new direction with the occupations of the farm sites. Salmon populations are alarmingly low, and as such, First Nations have lost food security. The provincial government is the landlord of the salmon farming industry as they grant the tenures, giving these farms access to the seafloor. The salmon farming licenses of occupation in the Broughton Archipelago expire next June. Morton, currently sailing on the Sheen in the area, points out that if the pens were restocked now, it will be over a year before harvest at the earliest. And hundreds of wild herring were also seen pouring out of the boat, causing speculation that they are likely to be taken as bycatch with the farmed Atlantic salmon by Marine Harvest Glacier Falls Farm. Additionally, the Victoria Viking vessel is not displaying a license that would legally allow it to transport herring or wild salmon. Marine Harvest was sued by Alexander Morton in 2012 for illegally transporting several tons of herring in their vessel, the Orca Warrior. In an area where herring are protected and their fishery closed for 30 years, it appears that salmon farms are now becoming herring farms as well. And unfortunately, that's all the hot time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented each Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can listen to a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon. That's Friday at 3 p.m. Or you could listen to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 a.m. KRFP 90.3 Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m. Or WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. You could also listen to KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill in Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, and KPHD 93.3 also in Modesto, California, or Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 in Berkeley, California. If you can't listen to any of those, you can always go to radio4all.net. That's radio, the number 4all.net, where you can listen anytime online or download this or previous Earth First updates. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Uncle Dennis. Please tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.